This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember Richard X. Clark, who survived the Attica uprising in upstate New York.
He passed away last week, the 44th anniversary of the Attica uprising, and we speak with one of the attorneys on the team, Daniel Alterman, who represented some of the men 44 years ago.
An emerging movement driven by students is sweeping college campuses to strip classrooms of subject matter, words, and even ideas that may cause discomfort or offense.
Attorney Lukianoff has written the article in the recent Atlantic Monthly called The Coddling of the American Mind. And in it, he talks about the oversensitive college students who are forcing a shutdown of thought on the campus.
Attorney Alice Jennings joins us to talk about a class action lawsuit she filed in Detroit.
The lawsuit is about that the city of Detroit is turning off the water for tens of thousands of people. Detroit has already lost two-thirds of its population, and with this, there may be a public health crisis.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Today is the 44th anniversary of the Attica uprising, and we speak with one of the attorneys on the team, Daniel Alterman, who represented some of the men 44 years ago. Attorney Daniel Alterman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Mike.
Danny, the day that we're recording here, September 9th, is the 44th anniversary of the Attica massacre. Tell us about that, will you please?
On September 9th, 1971, the Attica brothers, white, black, brown, Asian, went on strike due to the terrible conditions that existed in the prison system at that time. And that for 4 days, there was negotiations back and forth between the state and the observers that were sent in and requested by the brothers who had formed their own society in D Block Yard. Instead of negotiating, Governor Rockefeller and head of the Corrections Commission, Oswald, sent planes with tear gas and then opened fire on the inmates using dum-dum bullets, deer guns, all sorts of weapons from a few feet away that killed 43 people, which was the largest and bloodiest massacre on United States soil since the Civil War. I think it's really important every year on September 9th to remember that not only is Attica all of us, but Attica means fight back.
Danny, how did you get involved in the Attica litigation?
The National Lawyers Guild anticipated when there were all these people in D-Yard, I think about 1,700 people, that in the event that the state would refuse to negotiate and went in and retook the prison, that there would be reprisals, and got teams of people and lawyers ready to go in there when they took back the prison. The legal teams got a court order from Judge Curtin of the federal court to go into the prison with lawyers and medical personnel because the prisoners were being killed and brutalized and beaten and not provided clothes and medical attention for the first 4 days after the rebellion. But in the context of the false claims of torture by inmates of guards, they got the judge to rescind that order, and it took 4 or 5 days for people to finally get the court orders obeyed by the wardens of Attica, and I was one of the first lawyers, if not the first lawyer, to go into prison on September 16th or 17th, 44 years ago, 1971, when the inmates were still naked, still had open and oozing gunshot wounds, were still being tortured and brutalized and burned with cigarette butts and all the most terrible things that was done.
Danny, we wanted today to remember Richard Clark. Can you tell our listeners who he was?
Richard Clark was one of the most visible Attica brothers that articulated the concern and the desire that people be treated as people and not because of prison be tortured and treated like animals. And Richard had a dignity that was apparent to all of us, that he could identify and put his finger on the pulse of why and how purposeful and how necessary it was to fight back. So in Richard's words, and we remember him so vividly today, 44 years later, because of the fight in which 43 indictments, tens of thousands of years alleged imprisonments, the state spending $25 to $30 million simply to prosecute the brothers and not prosecute any of the guards. And we remember him today for what he did and the leadership that he demonstrated as one of the public faces of Attica, along with Frank Big Blacksmith, Akil Aljunde, Jomo, and lots of the other brothers who have passed on.
Yeah, Richard X. Clark, Presente, he passed away last week. He went on after Attica to be a real leader in the country. And just one last question, Danny. What was your relationship with Richard, and how do you remember him?
I remember him only with good thoughts. It was a very, very difficult time. The brothers were facing tens of thousands of years in imprisonment. Most of that stuff was false. Most of the indictments were not based on fact. The inmates had to fight every time they went to court because the guards were fighting with them. And Richard stood above a lot of that and was able to articulate love and understanding while still maintaining the faith, Attica means fight back.
Danny Altman, thank you so much for this update on the anniversary of the Attica uprising.
Thank you so much, both of you. And I don't think it's possible for those of us who were at Attica and remember it to go by any of the anniversary days without thinking back to so many people that have gone, but how necessary it was to fight back and to confront the state. And Richard Clark was a giant among the people that protested the treatment of the prisoners at Attica.
Danny Altman, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both very much for asking me. I appreciate it.
We speak today with attorney Greg Lukianoff, who, along with his co-author Jonathan Haidt, wrote the recent Atlantic article, The Coddling of the American Mind. In the article, they argue that in the name of emotional well-being, college students are increasingly demanding protection from words and ideas they don't like. Greg Lukianoff will speak to us about why that's a disastrous idea for education, for mental health, and because it creates bad law. Attorney Greg Lukianoff is the chief executive officer and president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education and the author of the recently published book, Unlearning Liberty.
Greg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
In your recent article, you detail an emerging movement on college campuses to essentially strip our classrooms of subject matter, words, and even ideas that can cause discomfort or offense to students. How widespread is this, and how did we get here?
Well, you know, I'm a First Amendment lawyer, and I've been defending free speech on college campuses since after working at the ACLU of Northern California. I started back in 2001 with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and I've dealt with truly ridiculous cases of censorship on campus for all of those, 15 years now coming up on. I list them in a book called Unlearning Liberty. But one of the reasons we felt compelled to write the book was because overwhelmingly during the last 15 years, the problem has come from overzealous administrators, sometimes throwing their weight around, sometimes thinking they're helping, sometimes out of fear of litigation that was often really quite exaggerated. But the thing that really seems to have changed in the past 2 years that actually I find very upsetting, because I love defending the rights of students, is that a lot of the requests for language policing is coming from the students themselves.
In your article, and we want to talk about the legal aspects, but
sure.
You do deal a lot with what to me sound like psychiatric terms, microaggression, trigger warnings, vindictive protectiveness. Can you give us a few examples about what to inform the meaning of these terms?
Absolutely. And part of the thing that why John Haidt and I were excited to write this article was John Haidt is obviously an expert in psychology. I'm sort of a hobbyist. And in my experiences on campus, the behavior that I've seen administrators modeling is what is called in cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive distortions. And cognitive distortions are basically mental exaggerations, things that you tell yourself that are sort of that are unreasonable. That, you know, to give a classic example, you know, if I flub this interview, my life is over. If this person breaks up with me, I will die alone. These are all things that pretty much everybody says to themselves to some degree. But the amazing innovation of cognitive behavioral therapy is that it just trains you through pretty rigorous attempts to get you to talk to your interior dialogue in a sort of more rational and fair way. And what's so striking about it, and it's one of the most successful interventions for both anxiety and depression over the last 50 years, is just doing that actually makes you less anxious and less depressed. And I'm living proof. I've benefited tremendously myself from CBT. But meanwhile, working on campuses, what I've seen is particularly administrators modeling cognitive distortions for students. Probably the most classic one is what's called catastrophizing. And catastrophizing is exactly what it sounds like, thinking that, you know, some minor thing that goes wrong is the end of the world. And I've seen this, that administrators demonstrate this through zero tolerance policies, for example, where, you know, we talk about a case in the article where a professor posted a picture of his daughter wearing a Game of Thrones T-shirt that included a quote from Daenerys Targaryen saying, "I will take what is mine with fire and blood." Not exactly terrifying, and certainly if you know the show, you know, you just think it's awesome. That professor, for putting this up on Google+, was suspended for a week and sentenced to mandatory psychological counseling because the administrator there interpreted it as a threat to the entire campus community, and even went so far as to say that fire could refer to the fire of AK-47s. And I see this in case after case where it's like, are you really trying to teach a generation of students that smart adults overreact to everything?
You know, you use the term unwelcome, kind of a subjective standard where these students feel that something that's said that they become aware of is unwelcome. And so you talk about there's no an objective standard anymore that's been abandoned
right.
In terms of, you know, a rational objective standard for what's weird and what's not. And instead, it's a subjective standard. So any overly sensitive or somebody with real personal problems can complain, get the administration behind them, and get the law behind them. And it's causing a real degeneration in the quality of education on a campus and a real constriction of free speech rights. And I wanted to talk to you about some of these cases and what the law is and how the law has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about the dropping of the subjectivity standard when it comes to harassment, that's actually not the law. That's just what the Department of Education is saying it is as of a 2013 letter to University of Montana. As far as the case law is concerned, when it comes to harassment, it has to be both objectively and subjectively offensive. But the Department of Education unilaterally decided that harassment can happen even if a reasonable person wouldn't have taken offense. Now, to consciously and quite directly take out the reasonable person standard from the definition of harassment is just, it goes against existing case law, but it's also a terrible idea. But it puts the person who's most prone to claim offense in the driver's seat, and that's a very hard model to successfully educate people under.
Greg, give us sort of an overview of when did lawsuits start happening? Is it students bringing them against professors? And what are the sort of primary kinds that you're seeing? Is it things like the case you just described, an offensive image, a piece of literature, curriculum, or what a professor may say in the classroom?
The litigation's been a big old mess, to put it in a very legalistic term. From 1989 to 1995, there were a lot of cases against campus speech codes that sometimes were, and of course, you know, they were mostly well-intentioned, but they were to go after racist, sexist speech, for example. But they were all shot down in every case they were challenged in, even in my alma mater, a private school, by the way, Stanford Law School. And so that was sort of the first wave of litigation. But then in the 90s, you saw an uptick in universities being sued for harassment and discrimination on the basis of primarily speech. And you saw the Department of Education get more involved in this. And up from that came this entire sort of cottage industry of groups like the National Center for Higher Education Risk Management that makes, frankly, an awful lot of money telling universities how to adjust their policies so as not to get investigated by the Department of Education or not to get sued. I actually think this has contributed to an environment where universities overestimate the likelihood of being sued for harassment and discrimination, and actually leads to some of these sort of overreactions, because it's not all just PC run amok, you know, a term I don't even particularly like. That some of it is that they've got it drilled into their heads that essentially they need to overreact or else they're going to face a lawsuit or be investigated by the Department of Education. Now, for most of my career, that's just not been true, because in 2003, the Department of Education came out with a very clear statement saying, listen, we're a federal agency. We can't tell you to pass codes that violate the First Amendment. That's not even within our powers. So if you're going to pass a speech code and reference harassment that actually includes protected speech, if you're a public college, that's unconstitutional. If you're a private college, you're doing that on your own. This is not the federal government doing this. But unfortunately, in the last couple of years, there's been a much more aggressive Department of Education. So right now, I think, and I might get this number right or wrong, but I think right now, something like 150 schools are under investigation for both harassment and assault. And universities are afraid of their handling of harassment and assault. Universities are afraid of these investigations because they tend to be very onerous and expensive. Meanwhile, the power of the Department of Education is to remove all federal funding, which is, of course, a death sentence to some universities.
Greg, give us an example, if you will, of a harassment claim. We've heard, I think, about Lady Chatterley's lover being banned or...
The drawing of a mermaid. Someone complained about that because the mermaid was topless.
How is that harassment?
Yeah, I've seen abusive harassment rationales all throughout my career, and I'll just give you some of the classic nightmare ones because obviously, you know, harassment is a real thing and it has a real definition. But the way you see it get applied on campuses sometimes makes a mockery of what that real definition is. So, you know, a classic example that I talk about in the article is the case where a student at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, was found guilty of racial harassment because he was publicly reading a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan. Now, what makes this ironic, it doesn't make it any more or less protected, but it just makes it ironic that this is a book available in the library, and by the way, it celebrates the defeat of the Klan when they marched on Notre Dame in 1926. So it wasn't even a racist book, but because the book had a picture of a Klan rally on the cover, and it had the word Klan on the cover, he was found guilty of racial harassment without even so much as a hearing, under this kind of zero-tolerance sort of anything that offends anybody is automatically considered to be harassment, which of course distorts the term out of all meaning.
Yeah. Your jaw just drops.
Yeah,
well, there is a standard that you advocate, and that's the Davis standard. Talk to us about that, because maybe we can kind of, you know, get a handle on this.
Yeah, you know, our radical position on this is to help make sure that universities aren't always overreacting to harassment claims, and also, frankly, to rein in the Department of Education. All we have to do is provide a clear definition of harassment, one that actually respects freedom of speech. And we think that the one that fits the educational environment the best, because it came in the context of actually a K-12 case, was a case called Davis v. Monroe County that was about 15 years ago. And in that, the Supreme Court really tried to be sure that if we're going to start policing harassment, particularly among students, we have to construct it carefully, unless you actually turn every time, girls and boys sort of mess with each other into literally a federal case. So they defined it as severe, persistent, and pervasive, such that it effectively denies someone an education. Now, this gets back to what the entire idea of hostile environment was originally supposed to be, which is essentially hostile environment was conceived of as this very understandable concept that you could make universities admit women and minorities, but it wouldn't mean all that much if that university could then make it such a hostile environment that women and minorities would not want to attend. And I think the Supreme Court really expertly balances the original intent of hostile environment law and the importance of making sure that the standard's tough enough that it doesn't start leading to ridiculous outcomes, like another case, a professor at Brandeis University who explained where the racial epithet wetback came from in his Latin American studies class and then proceeded to criticize its use. He was also found guilty of racial harassment. Under the Davis standard, that wouldn't be possible.
Are you seeing a difference between undergraduate and graduate students bringing these cases?
Let me broaden that question. That's an excellent question.
Yeah.
The other question is public schools versus private schools, all women's schools versus men's schools, predominantly black schools versus integrated schools. I mean, is there any way that you could discern one place from the other in terms of how many of these incidences are arising?
I'm going to give two answers, and they're going to be actually somewhat contradictory. One is it seems to be a massive mixed bag in my experience. I don't know why Princeton tends to be relatively well-behaved, and we see a ton of cases at Harvard, for example. I don't know why for a long time, we had a ton of cases at University of Alabama, and then suddenly we had none, and we haven't heard from, you know, a bad case come out of them again. And I tend to think the real wild card in these cases are the administrators at the university. If you have good leadership at the top, for example, that says, listen, we have to respect students' autonomy and their ability to deal with offense, and we're not going to tolerate things that actually chill the environment in the classroom, those are schools that end up really succeeding. But when it comes to things like trigger warnings and microaggressions and some of these kind of not so subtle but subtler than your average speech codes, language policing type things, I do tend to think, and I would really like to be able to do some studies to establish this empirically, but I gotta, you know, to show a little bit of sort of like an additional part of my perspective, I have noticed it more at sort of more upper class schools that essentially where they cater more to, forgive the term, rich kids, that I do see a lot of this coming from more elite institutions in a lot of cases, and a lot of cases coming from more affluent students.
The coddled ones.
Related to that, I believe in your article you've said that this is actually ill-preparing our students for real life, which makes sense, because how do you deal with something in the real world that you might have an issue with?
Well, absolutely. And particularly, you know, we all remember law school, and criminal law, of course, deals with sexual assault. You're not educated in criminal law unless you actually study the law related to sexual assault. That's why Jeannie Sook, a Harvard law professor's article in The New Yorker this past year, was so important and made it into the article, was because she talked about how professors are increasingly avoiding it as a topic because so many students complain about it being uncomfortable and triggering for students to talk about that. And this is a really troubling development because, obviously, who suffers the most in a society when lawyers are no longer trained to know the law of sexual assault? It's, of course, victims of sexual assault. This is so short-sighted, and it can potentially be disastrous.
So, for example, it would be taboo to mention the word rape.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the most
violence.
Dramatic example that Professor Sook talked about was the word violate. Well, actually having a student come and say, don't use the word violate because I personally find it triggering. Meanwhile, my background, in addition to First Amendment law, was all human rights law. I took human rights practice. I was very interested in this stuff. But you're not capable of practicing human rights law unless you're capable of at least hearing about, probably even seeing, some of the worst, most grisly aspects of human nature and of human reality.
I have a question about the chilling effect this has, not only on the professors, but about fellow students.
Yeah.
So what if you're in a classroom and you're then afraid to speak out about something? Doesn't that run counter to the principle of an academic environment and the exchange of free ideas?
It absolutely does, and it's something that's been interesting. I was expecting, and this is funny, when we wrote the article, since we take on, you know, topics that are considered somewhat taboo and somewhat sacred, like microaggressions and trigger warnings, I was expecting a lot more hate mail. But every time I've done an NPR show, I have some professors call in and say, oh no, this is absolutely what's happening. And when it comes to the students themselves, I hear this, you know, with every internship class we have, there's always students saying, yeah, I'm not going to, they almost take it for granted that you don't bother contradicting your professor if he's too opinionated, and that you defer to the most offended person in the room. But this is, of course, devastating to candor, which to me, like genuine candor, genuinely talking across lines of genuine difference is something that is so important to the formation of ideas and to give you a sense of the community in which you actually live. I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that, you know, that not hearing people what people really think is somehow helpful. But for empirical data on this, the American Association of Colleges and Universities did a 2010 study, so I want to actually do a study like this and ask the question slightly differently. But they asked students, is it safe to hold unpopular opinions on your campus? And that's, you know, funny formulation, but I think it was formulated essentially so that 100% of students would strongly agree that it was safe to merely hold. I think they were trying to actually get a skewed answer on this question. But what they found was actually not that at all. It was that only 40% strongly agreed with the statement that it was safe to merely hold unpopular positions on campus. And then for every year that they were there, so freshmen it was 40%. By the time you get to seniors, it's only 30%. And guess who had the most pessimistic view on if it was safe to hold unpopular points of view on campus?
I give up.
Professors.
Right.
That's funny.
Only 16.7% of professors strongly agreed with the statement that it was safe to merely hold unpopular views on campus. And even the administrators, it was 18.8% of all campus professionals strongly agreed with the statement.
So the professors are intimidated by the students, by fearing kind of an overreaction by the most sensitive, most coddled students, and the professors are bludgeoned down by that.
Yeah, and what's been slightly frustrating, I have to confess, is I wish more professors would stop telling me this in private and start saying it in public. So, for example, it meant the world to me that the famous journalism professor Jay Rosen at NYU, when after reading the article, tweeted out for the entire world to see, yeah, I'm concerned about this trend, and yes, I self-censor in class because I'm afraid I might be brought up on charges of harassment potentially.
It would seem to me that this would affect certain disciplines more than others. So, for example, in the liberal arts, literature, creative thinking, where we're hoping to nurture a new generation of real thinkers who tackle some of society's complex problems. Do you see this more in sort of arts and letters versus, you know, math and science?
Certainly, yeah. It definitely is the case. But that being said, I mean, some of the worst cases I've heard have been from social scientists and from psychologists, because obviously there's some really deep and dark theories of human sexuality, for example. You know, you can't read Freud and not be a little bit distressed
right.
by some of his
right.
theories.
Yeah.
But, you know, for an example...
But maybe we won't be reading Freud anymore, for example.
Well, right, yeah. So I definitely have seen, you know, students get in trouble for what they write in creative writing classes, for example, which is, of course, horrifying, because you would think that would be... I mean, I used to write fiction, and when you... And the stuff that, you know, college-age students like to write about, it was all filled with, you know, sex and violence and bad behavior all around, because that's much more interesting and fun to write about. And I just wonder what it does to, you know, some of the creative arts. But I think it actually is harmful to science as well.
You know, one of the ironies, Greg, that I find that this is such a violent society. Martin Luther King said
right.
the United States
yeah.
is a leader in violence around the world.
Yep.
And the not only is it the actual violence, but they're conducting six separate wars now, but it's also the violence of the culture. And yet you have inside the classroom, you know, people objecting to a drawing of a topless mermaid. I mean,
yeah.
what's your reaction to that observation? How do you square that?
I could not agree more, and it drives me nuts. I mean, like, for example, you know, like, one of the things that I did when I was in law school was I did refugee law in Eastern Europe, and that definitely, and I used to work with inner city high school kids in D.C. back when D.C. was the murder capital of the country. And when I deal with students, you know, who actually think that they should be protected from words, it scares me to death, because I'm like, no, we have really serious, tough problems to deal with as a country. There is some seriously bloody, awful stuff going on in the world that needs that needs your attention. And if we're going to waste all of this mental energy on sort of outrage theater, what a disservice we're doing to situations of actual violence, situations of actual oppression, situations of actual abuses of power.
Greg, you reminded me a few minutes ago, in terms of the topless mermaid discussion, how I think Starbucks years ago in their logo did have a woman, and they removed, I think, her nipples for the logo. But it reminds me of the corporatization of the United States, because it's making bland anything that has to do with either sexuality or radical politics, for example. It seems to be sort of mainstreaming and corporatizing everything.
I completely agree. That's also something that Harvey Silverglate said. And actually, this is a good opportunity for me to apologize to someone. Megan McArdle, who's a columnist for Bloomberg, wrote an article where she made exactly this argument, that one thing that we left out was that the corporatization of universities leads to this customer knows best mentality, which partially encourages the coddling and the deferring always to students. I think that that's a factor. I think that it's one of many, but I do think I think she's absolutely right. However, in a video I did for The Atlantic, I addressed a commentator who said basically the same thing, but said it in terms of, like, I think it's absolutely shocking that the obvious reason for this, and it was this very sort of strident, this is basically making the argument that that's the only reason why this is happening, and I don't agree with that one, but I think Megan thought that I was actually saying that specifically about her Bloomberg.
We hope Megan is listening to this interview. We unfortunately are running out of time, but I know that Michael and I would love to have you back on again to continue this discussion.
Oh, this is such a pleasure. I really enjoyed this discussion, and it's always fun to talk to other lawyers, particularly when you want people to be more concerned about some of these really, dreadfully serious situations and all these distractions we're engaged in.
Well, Greg, thank you both for your article, and we'll have to get a copy of your book, Unlearning Liberty. I look forward to reading that. And it's been a joy to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Keep up the good work.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too.
Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. One of this country's worst humanitarian and public health crises. In Detroit, Michigan, an estimated 53,000-plus residential customers of Detroit Water and Sewer have had their water shut off without notice from the city. It is unknown precisely how many of Detroit's children, elderly, disabled, or other at-risk persons are now living without water. That's because no state or local government has made a comprehensive count and assessment of everyone who's been affected. How did we get here? High bills in the city were often the product of irresponsible behavior by landlords, as well as leaky and aging water infrastructure. Rates have increased nearly 9% in 2014 and were scheduled to increase nearly 17% in 2015. The city, recovering from enormous debt, has responded with payment plans and other measures to address the problem, but none has worked. In July 2014, a civil lawsuit was filed pro bono on behalf of 10 families whose water was shut off. The lead plaintiff had her water shut off after her landlord didn't pay the water bill. She then sent her 4 children to live with relatives because lack of water makes a home uninhabitable under Detroit ordinances. She feared the protective services would remove her children. To fill us in on this crisis, the lawsuit, and what others in Detroit are doing to respond, is attorney Alice Jennings with the law firm Edwards & Jennings. Alice, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be on the show today.
Take us back, if you will, to April 2014. How did this unimaginable crisis happen with the water shutoffs?
Well, we've got to really start in 2013, and that's July of 2013. The city of Detroit filed an action for historic bankruptcy protection. And with that bankruptcy came just a whole range of issues around finances. Now, we were already a city with very high poverty levels, very high unemployment rates. It wasn't like a lot of blight. We had been hit very hard by the foreclosure crisis with the big banks and the various types of mortgages that had really stripped a lot of resources from the community. So along comes the bankruptcy. In that bankruptcy, many of the folks who had been historically receiving pensions from the city of Detroit, they had remained in Detroit, and part of the bankruptcy was to diminish the bank the amount a person could get from their retirement, as well as an increase in medical care. So right around the beginning of the year, there began a process of paying a company called Homrich, $5.6 million to go through and start shutting off water. And it manifests itself in the early spring of 2014. That's when the military-styled trucks rode down many of the core city neighborhoods and began to shut the water.
And there was no notice to most of these households.
No, the notice was zero. And part of what you've got to know is that the water bills in Detroit had historically been relatively low, and many times there was no effort at all to collect them. So at the time that the collection started and the shutoffs started, there were people sitting with maybe bills which were $1,000 or $2,000. And if someone lived in a home with poor plumbing, the bill may even be $5,000 or $6,000. So a lot of the homes that were Section 8, people had very high rates of water usage, but it had accumulated over a period of maybe 2-3 years.
Tell us, if you will, about the class action lawsuit that you filed. It was a little over a year ago.
Yes. Lawyers in Detroit, many from the National Lawyers Guild, from the ACLU, from the Sugar Law Center, and we also lawyers came in from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund out of New York. We just thought it was so wrong and so inhumane that many of the folks who were having their water turned off had no notice, so there were major due process violations. There was an equal protection argument based upon the fact that the corporations, some of which owed several hundred thousand dollars in water bills, some of the municipalities that owed several hundred thousand, if not millions, in water bills, they were not being requested to have their water shut off. Was folks that were making either low income or in the poverty range or have a very fixed income. And so what we saw is the city of Detroit, through its policies and procedures, were going after those who could least afford to pay what the city wanted, which was 50% of what they owed in order to get the water turned back on.
How many people are we talking about here?
Initially, there were thousands. Maybe the first 2 or 3 months, there were 5,000 to 7,000 in the first 2 or 3 months. By the end of that year, we had gotten up to 30,000 homes that had been shut.
So
we know by the beginning of this year, only 17,000 some odd homes had been reconnected. And so we know that there were people who had made a decision in Detroit to live without water. And many of them, of course, were children in these homes, 50%.
Just a fundamental question. How are people functioning in terms of going to the toilet? It seems that this would present an enormous public health hazard.
Well, precisely. When we presented our motion for a temporary restraining order to the bankruptcy judge, Rhodes, we presented testimony from the former director of public health here in Detroit, who said this is a potential medical issue of a very high proportion. We're talking about any type of disease that's waterborne or passed on in a school setting, measles, you name it, there could be an epidemic. And that even for seniors, not having water for a period of time, the dehydration that occurs with young, the very young, and with the very older citizens could be life-threatening. And so we presented the case through expert testimony. We also presented a nurse from U of M who testified about all of the medical conditions that arise when there's not enough hydration in the human body. And so, you know, eventually the judge ruled that, yes, we had made our case on irreparable harm, but the city needed to get its money. So we had a judge who went to the position of the profits were more important than the human right to survive. And we're on appeal in the district court, U.S. District Court, before Judge Bernard Friedman now.
And I understand that this has also been presented to the United Nations on humanitarian grounds?
That's correct. About the latter part of October, Michigan Welfare Rights Organizations and the People's Water Board and several of the organizations that were part of the class action. We had 10 plaintiffs, individual plaintiffs, and 4 organizational plaintiffs, Moratorium Now, National Action Network for the state of Michigan. And yes, we did eventually decide that that needed to happen.
Alice, can you talk a bit about the racial component to the lawsuit?
Well, we knew for sure that Detroit was, of course, a predominantly African-American city, but we knew also that the core component of the shutoffs were happening in neighborhoods that were predominantly, if not 100%, African-American. There's something in Detroit called Detroit Future Cities, which is a plan that basically envisions a new Detroit that does not include many of the Detroiters that have, invested themselves in this city for 30, 40, 50 years or so. And there's a urban removal that occurs when you start shutting off water for an entire block. Many people decide, you know, it's time for me to leave this neighborhood. We found that the water bills were being placed on homes, and those homes were then foreclosed on for, you know, $5,000-$6,000 water bills. So it became a tool to use to regentrify the city because it had been gentrified before. I mean, up until the riots of the 1967, 68, 69 period, this city had a substantial white population. There was white flight. So it was all interconnected to if there could be removal of African-Americans and Hispanics and other people of color from these core neighborhoods, they could re-envision them in some cases to be water runoff ponds for the DWSB water system.
Alice, let me get back to what you said was the judge's decision when he refused to rule in your favor. He said, but they have to pay the money. What's your answer to that? Where should the money come from? Or should anybody have to pay?
Well, precisely. We presented an expert in the field of water affordability plans. His name is Roger Colton. You may have recently heard about Philadelphia moving to a water affordability system. He's been involved with creating systems of payment for water companies and other utilities around the country. And so we brought in Roger Colton as our expert. Roger had put a plan together as early as 2005, which was not followed by the city administration at that time. But we re-upped it, and we presented it to Judge Rhodes. And we said, Judge Rhodes, if this plan goes into action, it will require the customers to pay so much in current bills, some in arrears, and there's ability to forgive some of the funds. And so, but there would be a requirement that the person had a low income or they were under the poverty level or just above the poverty level. They would have to show some proof of need in order to get on these kind of payment plans. We know that Roger Colton's plan, there would be actually more money coming into the coffers, because people wouldn't be cut off, and they wouldn't then decide to go off the grid, as evidently many thousands have done, and water simply become unaffordable.
Alice, what you're describing sounds like privatization resulting in constructive eviction.
Yes, and we have said that part of what was done in the bankruptcy proceeding in secret behind closed doors was to create a structure of a Great Lakes Water Authority, which is going to regionalize the water system. And in that memo of understanding, it's clear there's a paragraph after paragraph that says that a part of the water system can be privatized, or in fact, all of the system can be privatized. So the fight now is to make folks aware that this is coming, that this is just a step to eventual privatization, and that the fight now is to also, in addition to keeping the water on and or turning the water back on, is to make sure that a public system for over 100 years does not get turned over to a for-profit system, which is a nightmare.
I wanted to ask you more about the United Nations aspect of this. You know, Malcolm X was from Detroit. His nickname was Detroit Red. And he advocated bringing racial issues like this to the United Nations. And I wondered what body have you gone to in the United Nations and what kind of relief have you requested?
Well, the United Nations sent in two special rapporteurs. One was the Special Rapporteur for Water, Katerina de Albuquerque, and the other was Leilani Farrar. She was the Special Rapporteur for Housing. And they were here for approximately 3 days. They took a tour with us. We presented the legal case to them. We had our plaintiffs there to give absolutely first experience testimony to them, and we had a public forum at Wayne County Community College here where several hundred people attended and gave testimony. And they also went to talk to the mayor, I might add. After that three-day testimony, they came up with an opinion that Detroit was facing a human rights crisis, that we had gone retrograde on the issue of human care, and that there was a need to correct it. Unfortunately, our Mayor Duggan felt that the UN just came in to make him look bad, and there was no addressing of that at that time.
Alice, I also want to return to the issue of public health, because I can't believe that the City of Detroit Health Department would not declare this a state of public health emergency.
Well, the City of Detroit no longer has a health department. We have a Wayne County Health Department, and that department, the director said he felt that the shutoffs created a public health emergency and crisis medically. All of that was ignored, and that's why after the case was not successful, we pivoted into the legislative arena. Some of us lawyers from around the country who had become known as the pro bono Liddell lawyers went to Washington, D.C. and gave congressional testimony. We are working with John Conyers' office, Dean Conyers, on a Water Affordability Act for the country. We are working here with the Michigan legislature. Many of the folks who grew up or know about Detroit who are there in Flint, and also some of the other areas where the shutoffs are happening, we're working on a state of Michigan water affordability and safe water plan. So we've not stopped. The organizing has continued both legally, legislatively, and on the grassroots level. We know now, many of us did know we were not water warriors at the time, that water is a problem all over the country. And in many of the western states, it is at a crisis proportion. So unless now, if we do not start now in putting together a legislative response to water affordability and safe and accessible water as well, which we found in some areas, the issue is accessibility. Some areas don't have wells, they don't have running water, and they have to have accessible water in some municipal building. So we're looking at this issue from as many directions as we can, and we believe that we have bumped into one of the civil rights issues of our time, because without safe, affordable water, you know, there's not life.
Precisely.
So true. I noted in our introduction that one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit was a woman who sent her four children away to live with relatives because apparently there's a Detroit ordinance that makes a home without water, quote, uninhabitable, and she was afraid Protective Services would remove the children. What happened to her and her family?
Well, Ms. Lido, we were able to, through the various organizations, to get her water turned back on. At that time, there was actually some money for assistance. That money has since dried up, and we point to that as part of the problem. You can't have charitable assistance supporting this. But Ms. Lido, most recently, her water got cut off again. We're working right now. She's got a situation with a pregnant child, and we are working to do everything we can to get her water restored, even as we speak. So, you know, she is extremely fearful that the state of Michigan, which is its protective services, there is an ordinance that if a child is living in a home that does not have safe, portable water, that the child can be removed. And so part of what we have attempted to do is to build a support structure. Right now, there's We the People, one of the organizations, has been taking water to homes by the gallon. There's been next-door neighbors, friends, churches. The St. Pete's here is a water station. We've had some pop-up water stations develop across the city here where people can go and get water to take to their homes. certainly nothing that would could be used on the same level as running water in the home. But neighbors have run their water hoses from their water over to their neighbor's home in order to have that family have safe water. People are taking showers in schools and at work, anywhere they can get the dignity of a clean body, that's happening as well.
We're speaking with Attorney Alice Jennings in Detroit. She's one of the attorneys advocating for the community who's had their water shut off. Alice, is there an internet presence that you want to tell us about so that people can stay in touch with what you're doing?
Well, it's funny you should ask. We are right now building a website for the national legislative work that we're going to be doing by fall. And right now, the best website would be the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. We will eventually have a link on that website that can take you over to the national work on the National Affordable Water Act. So we're getting all that. We're building it as we're talking to you.
Well, let me conclude with one final question, Alice, and that's this. If you had your druthers, where would you like to see this go?
Well, the druthers is, of course, water is a human right, and everybody, every human being in this world should have the ability to have clean, safe, affordable, accessible water. But here in the United States, we have seen that where there's need, that this community of human beings have went and put together legislation that allows, for instance, food and housing, Section 8 and other. So we're at the point now in our history that we are going to have to provide through national legislation the right to affordable water.
Alice, before we close, if you'll permit a personal question, Heidi and I are interested in how you got to where you are. How did you started off somewhere, and now you're one of the leading advocates for a basic human right there in Detroit. And how did you get to what you're doing?
Well, I probably got there because I've been a civil rights and human rights lawyer all of my legal career. But my dad was a Teamster for 40 years, and I marched on the picket line, you know, was involved with some of his actions as a unionist over the many years. And I am a dear friend of Grace Lee Boggs and Jimmy Boggs out of Detroit. And in fact, I am one of Grace's administrators in taking, loving her through her transition. So I've had a lot of good people here, to General Baker, who just joined the ancestors, Marion Kramer. We have a activist community here that's powerful and strong, and it's been that way for a long time. So I'm just standing on shoulders and doing what I can do to fight power when it is ignoring the rights of human life.
Said just like a true radical lawyer and a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and we'd like to congratulate you on your forthcoming honor at their convention, Alice.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're a true role model.
I'm humbled by it.
Oh, thank you so
much. Alice Jennings, really, it's just been great talking to you. Keep causing trouble.
Right.
Okay. All right. Will do.
Bye-bye.
Thank you both. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.